talk about music a little bit. Anybody here watch The Voice? For The Voice is a reality TV show. It is artists, musicians who are trying to make it big, and so they go and they perform, but then they have these professional coaches, professional famous musicians who coach them along the way and try to help them find their voice. But there's times where even the coaches, like Alicia Keys, feels like she needs a different perspective. And so on one episode, she's been bringing DJ Khaled onto her team to kind of coach these people up. And with one particular artist who, by the way, had perfect pitch, hit every note, had great rhythm. I mean, everything technically about it on paper was perfect. But from this one person, there was something missing. And so this was his advice to this artist. Go to church. Go to church. Because anybody can sing a song, perform a song. But there is a passion. There is a heart. There is a soul to music that can't exist out there in the world. It has to come from a deeper part of you. You cannot just sing it with your lips. You're singing it from your guts. And I think on Easter Sunday, that's something that Christians can do well. We have this passion because we are singing about the very reason we have faith at all. Does God have an answer for death? What is this whole thing about eternity? And how can I make sure it's a gift that God would have for me? One of my friends, I was asking him a question. I was working on a sermon. And he said, I asked him, at your funeral, what do you want said at your funeral? And he said, why do you want to know? Well, because I'm writing a funeral sermon and I need some help. So he thought about it and he said, I want them to say that, you know, he was a good person, a good son, that kind of thing. And I said, okay, anything else? And he said, well, I guess I want them to say that he helped people with his life. Like his life was not his own, but that he used it to help people. And I said, that's really good. I mean, that's good stuff. And I think that's something we all need to consider when we consider the end of our life. Did our life mean anything for others? Because it certainly isn't going to last forever here on this earth. But it can if we're willing to pass on our love. I said, that's great stuff. Then he said, well, Jim, what about you? What do you want said at your funeral? I thought about it. And people are looking at my coffin. What do I want them to say at my funeral? Look, he's moving! That's why I want them to say at my funeral, because I am a Christian of resurrection, and Easter has taught me this. When it comes to Easter, you need to expect the unexpected. You need to expect the unexpected. Imagine the angel when the Marys showed up, and they showed up at the tomb, and the angel has rolled the stone to the side, and the angel is lounging, kind of like on an ottoman, lounging there, and I think giggling, like, they're going to be so surprised when they walk up here. And the other angels are like, knock it off, knock it off. You're not selling it. Like, act calm. He's like, okay, okay. And they come up, and they are. I mean, the title of the sermon is Fear Not, because it seems like whenever angels are on the scene, that's what they have to say first. An angel's on the scene, fear not. An angel's on the scene, fear not. And it's because we're just in utter shock. Like, God is doing something that's completely unexpected. And we're not exactly sure how to handle it. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. I don't know how many people saw this, but pastors aren't allowed to talk about it in church, and we're supposed to forbid you from reading them. I'm going to tell you, I read these to my kids like when they were 3 years old, and we read the whole series and watched the movies, and they're not too tainted. I mean, they're a little evil, but not much. Even in popular literature, they are asking the question of the answer we want to give. And in the book, the question is there any way to conquer death? Because death seems to always be hiding in the shadows coming after us. And the three brothers in the book, according to the story of the Deathly Hallows, were given three gifts to deceive death. One was the invisibility cloak, which it allowed you to hide and to slip by death unnoticed. One was the Elder Wand, the most powerful wand that's ever created. And then the other, the circle there in the image, you'll see people instead of a cross wearing this around their neck. Instead of, and the other one is the circle, the resurrection stone. Now, one thing J.K. Rowling never really answers in the book is, how fully powerful is the resurrection stone? Could it bring you back to life? Did it help Harry Potter in any way? Or is this just so you can summon the dead from the past? The books are asking all these questions because real people are asking all these questions. And then you think about us as Christians and we gather here, we have our own resurrection stone, do we not? It's the one rolled to the side after the earthquake with the angel sitting on it with an answer to the women, why do you look for the living among the dead? What made you think that Jesus would still be willing to be in there? Well, he's dead. And we've come with perfume and spices, and we got to take care of the body. And I know Joseph of Arimathea said he took care of it, but he's a man, and they don't know what they're doing. So we women have to make sure that the body is taken care of the right way, in a way that only a mother would know how to do this. And the angel's just like, wait, there's no body to be perfumed. There's no wrappings to be tightened. In fact, the linen cloths, they're lying there at the very footstool where Jesus' body had been laying. But what made you think that Jesus was going to let the tomb have power over him? In fact, what was Jesus doing after they sealed the tomb? The Bible tells us, but not in chapter 28 of Matthew. It tells us the chapter right before. I like to call this chapter the zombie apocalypse chapter. Anybody here watch The Walking Dead? Anybody admit it in public in a church? Yeah, sort of, a few brave people. Did you know our culture is obsessed with zombies? They're obsessed with zombies. They're in everything. They're in all kinds of stories. And here's the best part. Do you know who wrote the original zombie apocalypse? St. Matthew. In the Bible. On Good Friday, there's an earthquake. The temple curtain rips. The ground is unsettled, and it says tombs started to break open. And then on Easter Sunday, when Jesus' stone is being rolled to the side by the angel, it says there's another earthquake, and then those tombs that have been opened out rattle people that others recognize. Now, we don't know exactly who they were, but we know they recognize them. What was Jesus doing on Saturday when he sealed in the tomb? In between dying and rising, what was he doing on Saturday? We called that Holy Saturday, and I thought maybe next year, maybe we'll have a Holy Saturday Easter vigil. Because it's one of the most peculiar, strange things in the history of the church, and we never talk about it. What does it say in the creed? Jesus descended. Some translations say to the dead, some say to hell. What was he doing in hell? What was he doing among the dead? We don't know. Christian theology has some answers. The church fathers have some answers, some possibilities. Some say he was preaching to souls of the Old Testament, the saints of old, to introduce them to the Messiah. And if they would see the Messiah and love the Messiah and have faith in the Messiah, then they were included in the covenant as well. Some say that. Others say that he went to hell and he was down there taunting demons like, you don't think you can hold me down, do you? Right? Some say that kind of stuff. He's taunting the devil. He's letting death know you can't have them. There's others saying that he's preaching to anybody who has never heard the good news. But he's doing something that conquers death. And I think we need to refine this. Now, somehow, I guess, maybe that preaching is what led to this zombie apocalypse. Now, we don't know that any of these people that came out of their tombs, we don't know if they died again. We don't know if they were people eaters, like, we don't know if, like, kind of in Walking Dead, if they're that crazy, or we don't know if they're just sort of casual, like, guy comes home, is like, hey, honey, I'm home, and she's like, passes out, like, you were dead, like, 5 years ago, and I got a new husband, and now I'm freaking out. We don't know, because the Bible won't tell us the rest of the story. What is the Bible telling us? Expect the unexpected. It's leaving us with a mystery. What are we to do with a verse like this? It's one thing to believe like our souls might go to heaven or something. Quite another thing to see people resurrected and walking around. Quite another thing. Don't let Hollywood steal our story anymore. We've got the zombie text. That's ours. Let's make sure we tell the whole story of everything God is doing on Easter. The stone rolling away, the angel on the stone. There's another stone in the Bible that's really, really famous among Jews, but we never think about it. And this stone is covering a well. So this is a story where Jacob meets Rachel. And anybody that likes a good love story, here it is. Jacob shows up at this well. It's got a massive stone over it. And the reason they did this is two. One, they wanted to make sure they protected the water from getting tainted. Like no dead animals could fly in there or something. Because if you ruin the water supply, what happens? They're in a desert-type climate. Everything dies. The flocks die. You have no chance. You need clean water. That well is the most important, valuable thing in all of the culture there. So they had a huge stone over it that kept the water from getting tainted. And then number two, from evaporating. From evaporating. And wells were known to evaporate. When Jacob shows up, he wants to have a drink, but the stone is huge. And he asks some of the shepherds, when are you guys going to roll the stone away? And they explain to him, Jacob, we have to wait. We have to wait till all the flocks come, because then all together we'll have enough manpower to move the stone. We all get our water, and then we quickly close it again. You can't just come up and get your own water. All the flocks have to come if we're to share of the well. Jacob is a little impatient, probably like I would be, but he knows he has to wait. And so he's kind of sitting there waiting. And then around the corner, here comes Rachel. Now, biblically speaking, the Bible says that Rachel was hot, like really beautiful. And he's so smitten, he does this dumb thing that guys often do. He puffs up his feathers. He probably asks her, like, which way is the beach, honey? You know? And then he goes up to the stone, and he sees that she has flocks that need to be watered, and he decides to roll the stone away and then stands back up like his back is not hurting and gives her a wink. It works. She goes back to dad, and the rest of their story is a family. It's a family. It's a complicated story, but they do get married. They do have children. And Jacob and Rachel, their story really, this whole love story, is Israel being started. His tribes, his sons, become the 12 tribes of Israel. And the story of God's people then presses through the entire rest of the Old Testament until Jesus. One day, Jesus finds himself also at a well. He's in Samaria, and he's at Jacob's well. And there, he meets a Samaritan woman. Now, he's a rabbi. He is not supposed to be around Samaritan women. This is somebody who worships the wrong way. This is a woman who's had 5 husbands. She's probably barren. This is a woman who's now living with a man who's not her husband, and Jesus is supposed to be a good rabbi. This is like me when I go to Colorado. I go around Oklahoma, not through it. I need to make sure not to be tainted. Hook 'em horns. But not Jesus. He's better than your pastor. He goes into Samaria. He meets the people of Samaria. And not only that, he shocks the woman. He's willing to talk with her. He's willing to be seen with her. And some say maybe she was a prostitute. He's not worried about what people think about him. And then not only that, but he asks her for a drink of water, and he doesn't have a bucket. So what is he to drink from? Her bucket, the one she drinks from. She is so shocked, they enter into this conversation about worship. She's like, so you Jews in Jerusalem think Jerusalem's the only proper place to worship, and here we are in Samaria, you won't even let us down there, so is what we're doing down here not really worshiping this God? And by the way, I have a question for you. This was Jacob's well. My family came from Jacob. Your family came from Jacob. Are you better than Jacob, our grandfather? Great-great-great-great-great-grandfather? That story from exactly 2,000 years ago, Jesus. Are you better than him? And Jesus' answer is essentially this. I have come to offer you living water. Not well water, spiritual water, living water. And the Christian mind starts saying, oh, he's thinking baptism. He's thinking about this washing away sins. He's thinking about the river of life that flows from the throne of God. Like, we have all these images running around. What Jesus is saying is this: I have come to put the whole family of Jacob back together. Here's the problem. If all the flocks are together, if they're not all there together, You can't roll the stone away. And Jesus battles that for the rest of his life, his ministry. And we, the church, battle that too. See, we want to roll the stone away and look in the tomb for ourselves. But how often are we willing to wait to roll the stone away so that everybody gets to look in the tomb and see the story and see the linens and see the resurrected Jesus? That's our calling. That's who we're supposed to be. Look at the Epistle of Peter, what it says in chapter 2. It's talking about this idea that Jesus was the cornerstone, the capstone, the one who was rejected by the builder, and yet he is the true cornerstone. And then he calls us to be living stones. Jesus is the cornerstone, but he was rejected by men. Why was he rejected? Because he loved outcasts, because he drank water with Samaritan women, because Jesus chose tax collectors as disciples, because Jesus believed in people even when they were too far gone. He believed that forgiveness and love could change their hearts. And so he was rejected. So then what is his task for us? Be a living stone. What do living stones do? They wait till all the flocks are gathered, and they let their living stone roll away, whatever the barrier is. Whatever the barrier is for somebody to come and to know Jesus Christ, to see the love of God, whatever that barrier is, we roll those stones away. I have a friend. He was a former student at Concordia University, and I met him. His name was Mark, and Mark was now training to be a pastor, and he was going to be ordained and called by the church he grew up in. The church, like he was like a 12-year-old going through confirmation. Yeah, that pastor was going to ordain him, and that pastor was then going to welcome him onto his staff, and they were going to get to work together. And then a couple days before one of their Sundays, and just a few weeks before his ordination, unfortunately, Pastor DeVries died. And Mark, of course, wasn't sure what to do. Like, he's just a few weeks from getting ordained, and now he's the only pastor there, and he's got to preach on Sunday, and he has no idea what to say. He goes into Pastor DeVries' office, and he's praying, and he looks on his desk, and he sees Pastor DeVries' last sermon, the one he intended to write on Sunday, the one he intended to preach. And so Mark got this idea. He said, what if he did get to preach that sermon? It's just I'm the one that read it. And so he took the sermon, and he read it, and it was gorgeous, and there wasn't a dry eye in the room, of course, right? He had been there for 20-something years. He was Mark's mentor. Everybody loves Mark. So he's preaching a sermon, and it's just incredible. And then he gets to the last line. And isn't this so, Jesus? The last line of the sermon is the best line any pastor could ever give his church if he's preaching and then he dies right now. This is the last line I want to preach. I'm going to say it and see if I die. We don't know what the future holds, but we know who holds the future. Still here. We don't know what the future holds, but we know who holds the future. And that's the message of Easter. You have no guarantee on when your coffin's going to be up here. You have no guarantee on exactly what your life is going to be. But you're called to be a living stone, to be faithful, to roll away so people can see Jesus, to be things that people can build their lives on so that they can know God. And in all of this, the one promise you're given is that God will hold your future, that his love is enough, and that he's going to be with you every single step of the way. And that, the two of us would be honored to preach at any funeral for any Christian who says, Christ is risen.
He is risen indeed.